Hello and welcome to Season 3 of Modern Day Philosophers. Thank you for staying with me to this point, or thanks for just discovering this now, or thanks for tuning in and out. Either way, I appreciate the fact that you're with me. This week is Marc Maron on the show. I'm excited. I hope you are. We talk about Spinoza, and we do it in his garage, in the famous Cat Ranch. And Marc, when I ran into him at the Comedy Store and asked him if he would do the podcast, was kind enough to invite me out there to do it, and even said, hey, I'll let you sit in my chair, which is a huge honor. And I found out it's the first time he's ever invited anyone to sit in his chair and use his equipment. So what can I tell you? I'm very flattered. And that's a prestigious thing. To me, that's a big deal, as I'm sure it would be to a lot of people. All right, I'm very happy to tell you that we have two sponsors this week. We are brought to you by Tent, and we are brought to you again by StandUpCrap.com, our ongoing sponsorship. And these are both, by the way, sponsors very, very close to my heart. They're sponsors that I have personal experience with. Stand-Up Crap is brought to you by Stand-Up Records, who put out my album, Some Kind of Comedian. And Tent is something that I partook in and really, really enjoyed. Let me tell you a little bit about Tent Encounters with Jewish Culture. Tent workshops are week-long residences for creative 20-something-year-olds, and they take place in New York, LA, Montreal, and New Orleans this year. They've got all kinds of really cool programs in comedy, food, fashion, journalism, creative writing, music, and a bunch of other topics. See all the details at www.tentsite.org. That's T-E-N-T-S-I-T-E. .org. Listen, on a more personal note, I did tent comedy last year, and even though I'm not usually a fan of this kind of thing, it really was great and even enlightening. They'll feed you, they put you up in a hotel if you're from out of town, and you spend a week with other people interested in something that you actually care about. And by the way, it's free. They'll cover all your meals, your tickets to shows. They cover just about everything, except you just have to get to the city where it's happening. In the program that I did, we did all kinds of things. What did we do? We went to the Groundlings, did an improv workshop with Michaela Watkins. We did comedy writing workshops with Yoni Brenner, which was really cool. He writes for Shouts and Murmurs and The New Yorker. We talked to a guy named Ken Levine, who's written for MASH and The Simpsons and The Jeffersons. We went to see a whole bunch of performances, including Sarah Silverman, Jeff Garlin, and Pete Holmes. And we read about and talked about the history of Jews in comedy with a brilliant historian, Tony Michaels. If you like hearing me talk to Marc Maron about Spinoza, you're going to love their comedy program, which is happening again in October. And like I said, it's not just comedy. There are programs happening all year on topics like food, journalism, music, and there's one that's a road trip to the civil rights landmarks in the South. You don't even have to be obsessed with the Jewish thing to do, Tent. You can just be curious. There's no catch. Applications for the summer programs are due soon, and there's only 20 spots in each one. So get on it. You can find details about all the programs and how to apply at www.tentsite.org. Now, you've heard me talk a lot about standupcrap.com, and hopefully you've gone there and bought some stuff. I love Dan Schlissel, the guy who runs it. I love the product. I love the label. Can't recommend it to you enough. It's really, like I said, very close to my heart. I put my CD out on the Stand Up Records label, which is called Some Kind of Comedian, and I hope you pick it up. Stand Up Records is now proud to announce the launch of their online store at www.standupcrap.com, where you can buy downloads, and soon you'll be able to buy CDs, vinyl records, DVDs, shirts, and a wide variety of other merchandise direct from one of the best and most prolific comedy labels out there. Do yourself a favor and visit www.standupcrap.com today. Do it. Go. Buy my album. Buy a bunch of people's albums. They're all great. The guy knows what he's doing, Dan Schlissel. He really picks the cream of the crop. So go load up on them. They're super affordable. StandUpCrap.com. Build a comedy library for yourself. Turn yourself on to new comedians. Check it out. I know you want to listen to the show, and I want you to listen to it. So here it is. Me and Marc Maron in his garage, talking about Baruch Spinoza. I hope you like it. Here you go.
Hello, and welcome to Modern Day Philosophers.
Modern Day Philosophers.
Lewis.
Having failed to pay attention in school, Danny Lobel, now older and wiser, will attempt to learn basic philosophy 101. Our young hero will be joined by today's top comedians, philosophers all their own. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Danny Lobel.
Modern Day Philosophers.
How does it feel to be a guest in the garage?
It's weird. I've never been on the mic on this side.
It's an honor to be in this chair, and I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And I acknowledge it.
I'm glad to give you that.
It's got good comedy vibes in this chair. Maybe I can absorb them, you know?
Yeah, maybe. There's something going on in that chair. Something happened in that chair.
Yeah. It's like a magic.
Yeah, that chair changed my life. My life was changed in that chair.
Do you think anything has to do with the aura of the chair? Do you think any of it comes out of that?
Don't know where it came from.
So you don't know where this chair came from?
I do. I bought it at it's an institutional chair, and I believe I bought it at a thrift store in Silver Lake, and then I sanded it and then stained it impulsively. I believe it might, like a lot of these shelves here, some of these shelves that I got, I believe at the same place, are actually from the L.A. Los Angeles County Mental Hospital.
Wow.
So maybe that's from the same place, the same batch of stuff.
Huh.
I left the sticker on some of them. It says, L.A. Mental Health.
Yeah. And then the chair winds up being used in such a way.
Right? Yeah. So. I mean, look, I'm willing to invest a certain magic into objects.
Yeah. You put time into the chair and care into the chair, and the chair gave it back to you.
Yeah. Yeah. And who knows what it brought with it.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's going a little deep into the metaphysics, and I don't think we're there yet.
Not yet.
All right.
We can be if you want to be.
Oh, I don't know.
My Auntie Olga in Scotland, one time she told me, she goes, she cornered me.
Yeah.
She has big boobs, and she'll, for an old lady. She goes, Daniel, listen to me. Your gran gave me a very smelly perfume for my birthday. And I believe it was owned by an evil man. Because I put it on and a hornet came and stung me. And that's why I don't buy anything from a secondhand store. I will not buy a chair. I saw a lovely mahogany chair at a secondhand store. And I wouldn't buy it because it could have been sat in by an evil man, Daniel.
Mm.
So I always think about that when I think about like a chair. Like the.
Or the smell could have just been, a natural scent that the.
Oh, yeah, she's nuts. But.
Well, yeah, we're all nuts. Look, I get to fidget with the shit that I put out for other people to fidget with.
Who have been the fidgetiest people?
I don't know, man. I used to have little paper clips and stuff, and people, like, at some point, people pick things up. There's just a knife here now. Mm-hmm. There's some benders, you know. There used to be paper clips around. People bend them. I don't know who, specifically. I should make notes about that, but I'm not actually a therapist. So I don't...
At the end, everyone gets an evaluation.
Yeah, an evaluation, and then I secretly make notes of, you know, like Molly Shannon opened knife twice.
I think part of what's intimidating a little bit to a guest on your show is how perceptive you are. You don't let things slide very quickly. You notice a lot.
Unless somebody's really good at bullshitting.
But even then, I think your bullshit detector's so good that you'll pick it up afterwards. Like, kind of interesting with that Mencia episode that you did.
Right. Well, that was easy to pick up. Like, you know, there are people that have a public narrative and that they've shared a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And you can certainly hear the distance from, you know, whatever's going on in the present from this thing that they've said before.
Right. Right.
Some people who have said things before, you can get them to say it differently or take it a different direction. There are some people you're not going to get off certain chunks of their public narrative. And then sometimes people are just, you know, they'll charm me. There's been people that I'm not sure that I really got underneath whatever the hell it is that, you know, I don't know if I got them down to earth.
Right.
I don't know. Some people are more guarded than others. Some people are here for reason, personal reason.
Yeah. It's sometimes it's hard to cut through, like, what they've already built up so much.
Yeah, and some people, if they're fans of the show, like John Favreau, he had the whole show, he had done it all in his head. He had already interviewed himself as me and came in here and was like, all right, I know what you're going to do now. You're going to ask me about my dad? Is I was going to, you know, he knew.
That's interesting because, like, when I was on my way here to do your show, I was starting to go over what I'd talk about in my head, but of course, none of it came up.
Yeah, you're better. Like, you know, I think we all sort of do that. You know, I do it less than I used to, but, you know, if you're going to do any kind of media, part of you wants to prep, but it is kind of interesting not to prep,
because
then there's a especially on TV, because there's some guys that are doing it now where they're not producing the segments as much as they used to, or some certain guys do it differently, like like Fallon, he likes to wing it. Yeah. And, you know, Ferguson, you never know what's going to happen. And I used to be nervous about that because you want to hit your beats. But if you trust yourself enough, you'll figure it out. I mean, you talk for a living, so
yeah,
you'll work it out.
It's just trusting yourself to not be in control.
You know? Right, right. Yeah. Or to realize that, like, all the preparation you've done, you've been doing it since you were born. Yeah. Or on some level, you're a person that does that for, you know, you talk.
Sometimes
it's your job, you talk.
When I get psyched out, like before a big gig, and I'm like, I don't know if I could do this, and I'm backstage.
Yeah.
I try to think of a bigger gig that I've already done that went okay, you know?
That's how you do it?
Yeah.
I just sit in the panic, and then when I get out there, it's okay. hopefully, sometimes what saves me is that, like, you know, what can I do that will get me into the present? You know, what riff could I do? You know, what's happening right now? Mm-hmm. Like, I'll do the right now thing if I can when I get out there. So at least I'm there.
Yeah.
And not just going through shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't like that. I don't like the feeling of that.
Have you been more confident in doing that nowadays, since now you walk out there and people already, you have a funny stamp on you, you know?
Yeah, I think I'm a little more comfortable, and I think that I can usually identify when people are there to see me specifically. I'm still a little hard on myself about my my method, about my structure. Like, sometimes I think I should put more work into certain jokes or more work into organizing, but it seems to work out. Mm-hmm. You know, like right now, I got to start building another chunk of stuff because I've plowed through it. And I know that people still like to hear some of the other stuff, but like, I need to find some new stuff. So I'm in that zone where I'm just sitting on stage wrestling with things and not really clear on where things are going. I'm not getting on stage quite enough, but I imagine it'll work out.
Yeah.
I'll figure something out.
It will, I'm sure.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, do you want to jump into this philosophy?
Yeah.
Interesting thing about Spinoza. Well, I'll tell you three things that make this show different than others. One, I'm doing it in your studio.
Yeah.
In the Marc Maron chair.
Yep.
Another one is you are the first guest to request a philosopher.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I was hoping you knew something about him. I thought I was going to learn some things.
Oh, well, we'll hopefully learn it together.
Okay.
But the third thing is that I do know a little bit about him.
Okay.
And I brought a book over there. Underneath your books there is Maimonides' book.
Yeah.
Which is the first piece of philosophy that I got into, which led to me learning about Spinoza, which led to me doing this show.
Look how small the writing is. You know it's going to be dense.
Yeah. It's a hard book to get through, and I still need to reread it a few times. It's called The Guide for the Perplexed.
Uh-huh.
And that's by Maimonides, or the Rambam.
Yeah, the Rambam.
Yeah.
He was one of the great Jewish teachers.
Yeah. Up until he came around, you had the written Torah and the oral Torah as the Jewish tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote everything down.
All right, so he did almost like a translation.
Right. And then he had to speak to the philosophers of his time, what they were saying. So he wrote this book in response to Aristotle.
So he was like, that's philosophy devoid of divine, devoid of God necessarily?
Right. Or? So he was the first rational Jewish thinker.
Okay.
In terms of, like, rational understanding of God. And the main thing that I pulled out of this book was that in his understanding, to understand God, you have to have equally strong imaginative and intellectual powers. And that to understand God, Maimonides was saying, if you're too imaginative, you won't understand God. And if you're too intellectual, you'll never understand God.
Right. Well, right away, right at chapter one, he's discussing the idea of God, what is God, and the understanding that God is in man's image and vice versa.
Well, actually, he was also saying that God is not, the way people anthropomorphize God is just so that we can understand how to relate to him. But there's nothing human-like about God.
Right, right.
So, right. Which was...
I do that with my cat. I anthropomorphize my cat.
Yeah?
Yeah. Well, you think they have personalities and that they're saying things or thinking things.
I do it with my dog. I have a dog voice for one of them. But mm-hmm. The other one, she just barks in my head. Like, one of them I've allotted
so you pick
a
favorites.
Voice to.
Yeah.
I don't know. I kind of see them like Odie and Garfield. Like,
right.
You know...
So the idea is, like, you can't sort of box God. But if you need to box God to understand it,
right.
Then knock yourself out.
Yeah.
But, got it.
And then Spinoza kind of talks to what Maimonides was saying, and this is what I know about Spinoza, is that his big disagreement was that whereas Maimonides talked about God as an interpersonal God, someone like a God you could communicate with, who can affect your life, Spinoza talked about God as being the same as nature. Like, there's one...
Right.
I kind of see Spinoza's view of God and Carlin's kind of similar, like the big electron, you know?
Yeah.
So I that's how I understand Spinoza, is just sort of like everything... I think one thing, I don't know if Carlin said in a special or if I just heard him say it, was that basically that we're all just a pile of dog shit. We're the same thing.
Yeah.
It's the ocean, the sun, you and I, a pile of dog shit. It's all just made up of the same molecules and atoms. And
yeah.
And we're all kind of connected.
That doesn't help anything.
No.
I mean, the we're all kind of connected, it does on a molecular level. I understand that. Frequencies, molecules. But I don't love breaking things down to chemistry completely, because I don't know. I understand it, but I don't think it necessarily, to me, it's just an answer to a question that's a little tricky. I mean, how does it really help? Is that going to promote anything, that we're all just sort of different configurations of molecules operating at different frequencies? I don't know how that helps me, really.
But it's just a oneness, I guess it feels...
All right, the oneness. I can understand the oneness. Yeah, I like that.
Said that he came to that after an acid trip, so...
Sure. I get it. Yeah, I get that. I get the frequencies and the oneness and the waves and the molecules, and that we're all sort of operating in one big glob of life that stretches out over how God knows how much. Yeah, I mean, I understand that.
But it makes no difference to you at all, whether we are or
no,
aren't?
I think that if I ever seek solace on a spiritual level or in terms of... not so much faith, but that every once in a while in quiet moments, there is a sort of connectivity that I can tap into that's very present and very real. And that, I know that it's fleeting, but I also know that everything has a certain harmony to it, even chaos and decay.
How would you describe it?
How would I describe that feeling?
Yeah.
Well, there was a point where at some point I realized that that trees were sort of like lungs. Like, there was a moment where I realized that, the way the earth sort of functions, the way trees take in sun and water and stuff, and how they sort of brilliantly kind of manage the well-being of the planet on some level, that I was able to, that's anthropomorphizing on some level, but I was able to see the planet itself as a collective ecosystem that somehow thrives, and that everything at all levels, like all the different kinds of animals. I don't seek sort of like, well, there seems to be an awful lot of kind of animals that defy just sort of randomness, but I just kind of see it as this sort of mutating thing that is living as quickly as it's dying, and that I am part of that when I'm not beating up on myself. So if I'm not self-loathing, then I'm part of it. When I'm self-loathing, then I'm just part of me. It's like Martin Buber. Have you done Martin Buber?
No.
Yeah, I Am Thou. You know that, and I have very limited understanding of it, but I think on a good day, I can feel the presence of being part of the big thing. Wow. On a bad day, I'm fighting the big thing.
Yeah, that makes sense. I like that. I like it a lot.
Fuck the big thing. ultimately, you can't avoid the big thing because you are part of it. But if you're sitting there going like, well, fuck the big thing, there is no big thing, and this is bullshit.
Right.
Yeah, that's you, enjoying your freedom as a human being, devoid of connection with the big thing.
Yeah. Do you think there's a way to enjoy freedom connected to it as well, or you have to break off?
No, I think that if you have a foundation with it and you have peace with it, that, there's a real good chance that that nothing might happen when you die, and, you let go of the metaphysical element of it, and that... your wisdom is based on your experience and the decisions you make and how you treat other people. But I think that when you are in concert with the good of humanity, which I think there is, you can intellectually say that it's all awful. But, I think you can find peace in that.
When you're talking about this connection, do you feel that it's a spiritual connection? Would you use the word spiritual?
Yeah, I'm not real clear what it means. Like, even right now outside, the light, it's very clear out. It's the air is clean. The sun is setting. It's pretty stunning out. You can stand out on the deck and see a few miles to the edge of the earth. But I don't know what's going on in China. I don't know what's happening in India. I imagine there's a lot of chaos in different places. And some people are fighting and someone's getting stabbed in the eye right now. But is it spiritual? I think that every once in a while, when you kind of picture yourself standing at the point that would be the top of the planet in relation to your feet, just sort of hurling through space, that it is sort of an amazing and miraculous thing that you shouldn't take for granted. So I don't know if it's spiritual, though. I think it's only spiritual if you can feel that in your heart and you can sort of let go of you know, how small your life is and sort of kind of actually, you know, breathe into or feel the sort of endlessness and the magnanimousness of the universe. I guess that's spiritual. I don't know how you would define that. How do you define it?
I guess the closest I could say to having felt spiritual before I come up with an actual definition is on Yom Kippur's, on when I do Yom
Atonement.
Kippur. Yeah, and I think, and this is my personal theory, that the times when I feel the most connected to God, or what I perceive to be God, it's when I'm in the most, again, I'm going to use the word spiritual until I come back to it, spiritually pure place. And I kind of relate it to detoxing from anything. When I've been really wasted, there's no clarity.
Sure.
And if you go up to a guy who's really wasted and try and talk about some kind of a clarity, or it's hard to connect. You know, so then in order for them to get to a point, you got to detox, and that can be painful, you know, and that's kind of Yom Kippur, is kind of like there's like a pain in it, like in a way of just,
well,
like
it's
fasting and
right. But it's also a sort of not so much a punishment, but you have to reckon with yourself, and you have to, you know, search your heart and your mind for, you know, what you need to atone for. So yeah, it's definitely a detoxification process, and it also entails a certain amount of honesty with self. Yeah, I think that, like, you, when you're able to really sort of take responsibility for your transgressions, if you're going to use this religious context, it can be very purging and very challenging, because there's grief involved, there's sadness, and there's also the humility of asking for forgiveness and knowing that you have transgressed, and feeling peace with that stuff, if you can, however you're going to do it, whether it's with, you know, a priest or with the air or your dog, whoever you're going to confide in. There's definitely, I could see how that could be a spiritual moment, to be forgiven or to be relieved of that burden.
Right. And I think for me, it always comes like a little bit after 3 o'clock. Because by that point,
when you're just starting to be able to eat again?
No.
You mean on Yom Kippur?
Yom Kippur. Because I've been fasting for a while, there's that painful, like, I'm still in a fast, like I'm kind of coming off food. Like, it's kind of like I'd imagine going cold turkey on a very low level.
Yeah.
You know, for me, food has always been a drug too. Mm-hmm. So there's that grappling with, I'm not eating, I'm not drinking, and sort of like, I should break this right now. I should go and eat. I should go and drink. And then there's, you know, just stick with it, only a few more hours. And then around 3 o'clock, a certain calm always comes over me. And I feel like kind of clean from the drugs that are physicality and food and stuff. And that's when I feel like I can connect to something that I would define as spiritual, where I feel a connection to something greater in the universe. And that's the best way I can define it.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I feel something greater than the universe, most of the time. Yeah, I probably take it for granted, but I mean, you know, the universe seems pretty great. You know, it's a great stroke of cosmic luck that we're all able to live and breathe on this rock. And I get that. I'm not as grateful for that as I am just the world that I work through. I mean, I find that as I get older, that things are less important to me than they used to be, that I behave a little better, that I'm a little more honest with myself and others, that, you know, I'm not as selfish, and I can make choices to not be selfish. You know, I spend time with my brother and his kids, and I actually was, you know, present for it, and open-hearted about it, and, you know, and I have a very hard time experiencing love, being able to give it or receive it, just because I'm a little guarded. And, you know, as that stuff sort of melts away, that's sort of spiritual, but I also think it's very human. And I think that a lot of times that just the human experience is challenging, and the ability to be selfless and show up for other people, or be able to be present for someone else's trouble and hold the space for them. I think that that's spiritual in a way, in more practical for me than, you know, wondering, you know, what is or, you know, what isn't God or the universe.
It's kind of almost the same as saying selflessness is spirituality.
Well, yeah, I think that getting past, well, yeah, sure, because that's the idea of getting past the ego at all. I mean, that's why most spiritual disciplines have some sort of ego annihilating bit of business. So you can get to the pure stuff and then, you know, kind of replace your ego with whatever consciousness is being purveyed to you. As an answer.
Yeah. It goes back to the old, better to give than to receive.
Well, no, that's a hard one. It's tricky. It's tricky.
Oh, I'm... Why were you going to say it's tricky? I'll tell you what I would think.
Because what if you want it?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. If it's better to give than to receive, but then you're receiving the good feeling from giving, then you're still receiving. So then it's better to receive.
If you can give with a full heart, as opposed to like, all right, here, you take it. You know, it's different. I spent a lot of money on this. Yeah, I hope you like it. To hear
it. Just take it and leave. So I forget that I ever had it to give you in the first place.
Well, that's tricky. You know, the idea of charity and the idea of service and the idea of helping others and, you know, and putting yourself second is contrary to, I think, most people's nature. And a lot of times you'll find you're doing that stuff for selfish reasons. You know, like you're like, I'm going to give you this because I hear that giving is better than receiving. So I'm going to see how this feels. All right.
Again, trying to receive.
Yeah, I'm only giving you a ride because I hear it's something I need to do to be a better person.
Right.
Now get out of my car.
Selfish giver.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think a lot of it is. But I also do think that if you can experience the feeling of selflessness in a real way and not a petty way, that it is fairly elevating. It's kind of interesting. It's a relief.
Would you say that's the best elevation or the greatest elevation in life?
Well, for me right now, the greatest elevation in life is unburdening some of the things that have been stuck in my, you know, my heart, you know, for a long time. I don't know how to do that, but I find that, you know, I'm 50 years old now, and I don't know that there are things that there are some, you know, basic human joys or at least human capacities that I don't know that I've really experienced. Like, you know, full trust with another person, you know, real intimacy. I think that I've store a lot of shame in my wiring that I have not been able to process. And I think that when you talk about religion and tradition and discipline and the idea of yearly atonement or actually using some of the rules of a religious life is somewhat designed to process that stuff. Mm-hmm. But if you don't buy that context or you don't live by it, you're sort of left to a hodgepodge of processes that you may not ever get to. But, you know, to sort of feel like you are being true to yourself, I think is an amazing feeling. And I imagine that some people have it naturally. I don't. So attaining that, even if it's for a few minutes, is kind of amazing. To hear your real voice or to feel your real heart in a moment of trust or release is pretty great.
Where do you feel that you're false to yourself?
Well, you know, you're protecting something sometimes. You know what I mean? And it's only smart. You don't want to walk around an open wound, though, you know, I do a lot of times. I'm a very sensitive person. But I think that, you know, to really feel... you know, present and like you are exactly who you are. There's some integration that has to happen because, you know, I bring a lot of marks with me. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a mark that engages with others. There's a mark who's funny. There's a mark who's still very young emotionally. So like for me, because of my fragmented sense of self, you know, the integration is what's happening. And obviously as you get older, that, I think it just happens naturally, or else you just close certain doors. But for me, there's still some stuff that needs to sort of line up.
Are you just waiting for them to all merge into one mark?
Yeah, that'd be nice. And it's not a schizophrenic thing either. But like recently, I've just found that, you know, a lot of the relationships I've had in my life, you know, served a purpose, you know, other than relationship. Sometimes you're in relationships to avoid parts of yourself. Do you know what I mean? Sometimes, you know, drama and petty engagements and you know, giving and taking is not coming from the heart. It's actually insulating your heart.
It's distraction.
Yeah, it's avoidance.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the risk of being seen, you know, in a genuine, true light is pretty it's pretty heavy. I mean, I think that's also coming back to Yom Kippur is really sort of it, is that, you know, that's the day that God's going to, you know, give you the, you know, he's going to, you know, write you in or he's not. So you have to be as sort of honest as possible and let God see you and see what happens.
Right.
Yeah.
It's just coming to terms with your own honesty, basically, you know.
Yeah. Or being honest with God.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say. But
sure. Right. Yeah, right.
But it's also really just being honest with yourself. And whether or not
that's
God,
true,
you know, you can use God in the context of, you know, maybe it's hard to sort of be honest with yourself without having an anthropomorphized being to
I don't have any anthropomorphized being. I used to, like, when I tried to think of God, I saw him as a giant genie. He looked kind of like Mr. Clean, you know, from the, you know, like a large bald man that stood bigger than mountains, and he had genie pants on, and his arms were crossed. Don't know. Think you might have had an earring. Maybe this is a repressed sexual memory.
What if we uncovered that here?
That'd be amazing. Like, oh my God, my original conception of God was based on a drifter that came into my house and made me suck his cock when I was 4. I said, now I'm free.
Maybe that's the magic of the chair that you're in.
Oh my God! Yeah,
that,
yeah. This
the
is
guest
the,
chair will open shakes. You up to.
Maybe that's true. That'd be funny.
All right, I'll tell you a bit about Spinoza.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, he lived from, well, I'll be specific, November 24th, 1632 to February 21st, 1677.
Really? How is that? Oh, that was Maimonides, the 12th century. Yeah, right, go ahead. Yeah.
He later changed his name to Benedict de Spinoza, which is when he was exiled. Well,
he was, what was the original name? Baruch Spinoza, right?
Baruch Spinoza to Benedict de Spinoza.
They even changed their names back then, huh?
Yeah, he went Gentile. I think he was kicked out of the Jewish community, if I remember correctly, but I'll get to that in a sec.
I think I have a Spinoza book up here.
He was a Dutch philosopher. The breadth and importance of Spinoza's work was not fully realized till years after his death, by laying the groundwork for 18th century Enlightenment and modern biblical criticism, including modern concepts of the self and arguably the universe. He came to be considered one of the great rationalists of the 17th century philosophy movement. His magnum opus was Posthumous Ethics, in which he opposed Descartes' mind-body dualism. It has earned him recognition as one of Western philosophy's most important thinkers in ethics. Spinoza wrote the last indisputable Latin masterpiece, and one in which the refined concepts of medieval philosophy are finally turned against themselves and destroyed entirely.
See, that's the thing about philosophy, that the reason why it's hard for me to access. I have Spinoza here. Philosophy is an ongoing dialogue between philosophers, and that dialogue gets a little convoluted. Mm-hmm. Like, even there, well, who did he take on?
Well, he took on Descartes.
Yeah, so, like, you know, Descartes, I think, therefore I am.
Right.
And Spinoza said, no, you're not.
You don't think.
Yeah. That's bullshit. Okay, so okay.
But I think there's definitely something in every one of them that's interesting, at least, to explore. That's what I like about doing this show.
Okay.
Is that even when I take it out of the context of the conversation, the greater dialogue, there's always a thought that leads to a thought.
Yeah.
Baruch Spinoza, which was Portuguese, I'm guessing maybe they came from Portugal and they moved to Holland or something. I'm not sure. I haven't got all that information. But he was raised in a Portuguese Jewish community in Amsterdam. Okay, that answers that. He developed highly controversial ideas regarding the authenticity of the Hebrew Bible and the nature of the divine. See, as I remember, he's often cited as the person who was heavily influential in the Reformed Jewish movement, because what he basically said was that the Torah was man-written and not God-written.
Mm-hmm.
And that was another thing that really separated him from Maimonides, who was saying...
accepted the word of God.
Yeah. He's saying this is just like great literature, that great work of philosophy that we could take a lot out of.
Right.
But not necessarily written by a divine being.
Here's the first paragraph of On the Improvement of the Understanding. of Benedict de Spinoza, Baruch Spinoza.
Okay.
Or Benny. After experience had taught me that all the usual surroundings of social life are vain and futile, seeing that none of the objects of my fears contained in themselves anything either good or bad, except insofar as the mind is affected by them, I finally resolved to inquire whether there might be some real good having power to communicate itself, which would affect the mind singly to the exclusion of all else. Whether, in fact, there might be anything of which the discovery and attainment would enable me to enjoy continuous, supreme, and unending happiness. I say, quote, I finally resolved, unquote. For at first sight, it seemed unwise willingly to lose hold on what was sure for the sake of something then uncertain. I could see the benefits which are acquired through fame and riches, and that I should be obliged to abandon the quest of such objects if I seriously devoted myself to the search for something different and new. I perceived that if true happiness chanced to be placed in the former, I should necessarily miss it, while if, on the other hand, it were not so placed, I gave them my whole attention, and I should equally fail. See, I'm already lost.
Well, it's easier when you're listening than when you're reading, I think.
Okay.
But, I mean, what I got out of it, I think he's talking about psychology versus spirituality. Like, first of all, just...
materialism versus...
And then the second part is basically whether or not happiness comes from fame and money or it comes from something else. And if you gave up on the... hope that happiness would come out of fame and money and put it into the second.
Okay, there. He goes on to say, I therefore debated whether it would not be possible to arrive at the new principle or at any rate at a certainty concerning its existence without changing the conduct and usual plan of my life. With this end in view, I made many efforts, but in vain. For the ordinary surroundings of life, which are esteemed by men, as their actions testify, to be the highest good, may be classed under the three heads, riches, fame, and the pleasures of the senses. With these three, the mind is so absorbed that it has little power to reflect on any different good. By sensual pleasures, the mind is enthralled to the extent of quiescence, as if the supreme good were actually attained, so that it's quite incapable of thinking of any other object. He's talking about porn here. When each pleasure has been gratified, it is followed by extreme melancholy, whereby the mind, though not enthralled, is disturbed and dulled. Mm. This is making sense to me. I should probably read this book. I've had it for 10 years.
Yeah. You've got every kind of book in here. Like, when I did didn't you have an Artie Shaw book in here when I did your show? I don't know if it made it in the interview, but we talked jazz for a little while. And
I have an Art Pepper book.
No, I think you have an Artie Shaw book here, too.
Well, I have a book that I think Artie Shaw's in it.
I think if I name any cool person in history, you have it on one.
Maybe.
Of
I think that in the Bebop book, there's some Artie Shaw stuff. There's a great, I have a great book on Bebop.
I'm and almost positive you have a whole book on just Artie Shaw. I don't think you even know what you got in here.
Sometimes I don't.
Yeah. You've got a lot of cool stuff. How many Crumb books do you have? Do you have a lot of Crumb?
Yeah, I got pretty many.
I feel the presence of Crumb.
Yeah, there's Carload of Comics up there, which was one of the first Crumb books I had.
Awesome, yeah.
That's the best.
I'm trying to get him to do this.
I have the Bible. I have
the Genesis?
Yeah, I have the Crumb Illustrated Genesis. All right, so where are we at with Spinoza?
Cool. So Spinoza lived an outwardly simple life as a lens grinder, turning down rewards and honors throughout his life. So that's kind of like what you were talking about, the rewards and honors. He decided the fame and riches were not where you'd find the happiness.
It's sort of kind of a metaphor. He's a lens grinder. He enables people to see better.
Yeah.
Or to see things clearly.
Clearer, yeah. Huh. Turning down rewards and honors throughout his life, including prestigious teaching positions.
Yeah.
His philosophical accomplishments and moral character prompted 20th century philosopher Gilles Deleuze.
Yeah, he's right here.
Am I saying his name right? Oh, yeah. There he is. To name him the Prince of Philosophers. Spinoza died at age 44, allegedly of lung illness. Allegedly.
What does that mean?
Who knows what it... Maybe the mob got him. Perhaps tuberculosis or Cilicius?
I don't know, man.
I don't know either. Let's just go perhaps by tuberculosis.
Right.
Exasperated by fine glass dust inhaled while grinding optical lenses.
Holy shit.
Yeah. So in the end, his simple life killed him. Spinoza is buried in the churchyard of the Christian Newick Kirk in the Hodge. I don't know if I read any of those words right. But
the Hodge. Where's that? I know that. Isn't that in, where is it? The Hodge.
The Hollywood Cemetery.
Yeah.
No, yeah. Well, what it doesn't say in here is that he was exiled. He was put in Cherem.
By the Jews. What's that, purgatory?
Basically, they didn't like what he was preaching and what he was saying. And basically, he got taken in by the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of them didn't like what he had to say either for a long time. But ultimately, they were like, all right, fine, fair enough.
Well, it seems like he was practical.
Yeah.
And, you know, just being practical intellectually and rational and trying to answer the questions that religion just tries to sort of take for granted is problematic.
Right.
You know, why question God here?
He could be losing people jobs.
Yeah, yeah. We've got a whole institution built on this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he still kept the concept of God. I think that's also a debated thing amongst philosophers because, again, this is the one guy who I've actually come into the show with some research on, is that I think a lot of philosophers say, yes, Spinoza believed in God, but some of them say, no, he didn't really believe in God. There are those that argue he was atheist. He was just using God as a word to describe what he was talking about. But
the indescribable.
Right.
He was anthropomorphizing.
I listened to an interesting YouTube clip between, I think it was Richard Dawkins and Lord Rabbi Jonathan Sacks.
Yeah.
I like watching these debates over God on YouTube.
Uh-huh.
That's a good time for me.
I have no time for that.
This is what I do when I have a little...
I wish I could get my brain back into that, but I don't know. I don't seem to be troubled by it yet.
I think it's just because I was raised so engrossed in it.
Uh-huh.
That, you know, basically everybody from the community that I was raised in believes. And then when I transitioned into the community of comedy, you know, most people don't. And they're both very intelligent groups of people that I respect and found so many of them fascinating. And
I think the problem becomes the definition again.
Of God?
Yeah, because, like, I think, you know, if hard-pressed, I mean, you know, there's some things that people can't explain, no matter how rational-minded they are. And the idea of calling God God is a tricky business.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I would imagine that a lot of people who claim not to believe in God believe in something. You know, they know that, yeah, is it all answerable by science? Yeah, probably not.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's no closure on that business.
Yeah.
You know, you can speculate as to why, you know, we are having this conversation right now.
Well, that's kind of what the thing I was going to tell you that in the argument was that basically they talk about the universe as a system.
Yeah.
And how science is a method to understand the system.
Mm-hmm.
And then what Rabbi Sacks in this argument said was that in order to understand any system, you have to look outside the system.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, if the system is the universe, then what is, you know, what is producing?
Oh, the old God trick.
Yeah,
but it's the old trick.
But it.
Okay, you explained all this, but what about outside of that?
Right, but it's...
We're getting there.
But it's still interesting because basically when you're operating within any system, how can you see what's bigger than it, you know?
But what are you expecting out of that? I mean, you know, are you engaged in an argument or are you suspending your disbelief? You know, like, how does it serve you? I mean, you know, if you want to engage in the argument, it's just tedious.
Yeah, it's at the end of every one of these videos, they just say, okay, well, we've resolved nothing, and everyone shakes hands and they leave.
That's right. So I think that the idea that people are still discussing whether or not, you know, Spinoza believed in God or he didn't, God is a question of faith. It's not always a question of intelligence. I mean, you know, the big argument is that you got to be stupid to believe in God. Because that's just ridiculous. But there are degrees of that. I mean, it's really a matter of do you need faith in your life? And is just, you know, rational knowing the answers or believing in the pursuit of those answers enough for you to move through the world? Maybe it is. But if you want to have faith, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're saying that scientific explanations or philosophical explanations devoid of God are a waste of time, or they're not a noble pursuit, but they don't resolve the questions you have about the meaning of life, and you need to have faith in something, you know, something bigger than that. I mean, I can feel it in my brain sort of bending now, but I don't have any problem with people that have that. And I think that a lot of people that say they don't believe in God are just, you know, what I say in my act sometimes, or I've said it before, is that I was never taught how to use God. So if that's no use to you and all it represents is this divine being that may or may not exist, then, you know, I mean, either you're going to just not give a shit about it or say, no, it doesn't exist. But if you know how to use it, you know, if you were taught to pray, to humble yourself, to follow certain rules that contextualize your life and provide for you a way to behave as a decent person in your community or your life. I mean, many people say that those rules, you know, pre-exist God, that there's a sort of ethical code to human existence. But it's really just a matter of, like, you know, how your heart's going to feel, you know, part of something and how life is going to have meaning for you.
Do you think faith is a good thing?
Sure, why not?
Well, what do you like about it?
Well, I mean, I don't necessarily have it, but I think mostly people just want to feel okay. I think that without, you know, feeling connected to something larger, to some purpose, that the potential for cynicism and existential despair and you know, a certain sense of meaninglessness is highly probable. So, and I'm not saying that that's not what's at the core of all of us. I think left to our own devices, you know, devoid of sort of any sort of community or higher purpose or just basic purpose for our own life definition, that, you know, the amount of terror and depression you would feel would be profound. But there's nothing wrong with going there. I mean, you know, plenty of philosophy goes there. You can strip it all down. Well, that's a great intellectual exercise, but, you know, mm-hmm. you still want to enjoy your breakfast.
Right. like, that's the big fear.
It is, basically. I'd like to have a good shit, and I'd like to enjoy this meal.
Yeah.
Could you not talk to me about this now? I mean, really.
I think you're talking to someone who's never not enjoyed breakfast. Okay, so we have some quotes here. Do you want to hear what Alex says? What do Spinoza and Mark have in common? Marin describes himself as not caring if God factors into his life,
yeah.
which we talked about. This is reminiscent of Spinoza's idea of an impersonal God who does not interfere with us. Also, Spinoza and Marin are both Jewish.
Yeah.
All right, so you have that too.
This
is my guy, Alex. Yeah. I think we've gone through all this without him, but I'll read it anyway. Spinoza argues that nature, everything that exists in the universe, and God are the same thing. If God is the cause of and part of everything, nature itself then must be God. Saying otherwise would be redundant. Because nature is impersonal with us, God must be the same. Unlike the biblical idea of a personal God who interacts with us.
But it's interesting, though, because isn't that perception of God, though not anthropomorphizing, still contextualizing God, that, you know, it still comes down to this need to explain it in physical terms. And I think that they're probably the argument, you know, within the believers is that, you know, that you can't do that. That just by saying even nature or the universe or whatever is God is still contextualizing something that is undefinable. Mm-hmm. So, you know, then you get back to that thing.
Yeah, for sure. I talked to a guy, Eric Kaplan, on the show a little while back, and we talked about just the idea of every one of us sort of being a cell in the body of God.
Yeah, I've thought of that one, too. Yeah, that's all good, too. But, see, that's the sort of human brain. Yeah, you know, that's the sort of point. The point of belief, the point of surrender, is that the human brain, you know, you're going to want to, you know, make up all these things.
You got to relate it to yourself somehow. Like.
Right, but the thing is, it's completely irrelatable. Mm-hmm. You know, and that is the precipice of belief.
Well, that's going back to Maimonides. Is basically, like, there is no way you can understand God, so the best you can do is try to figure out a way to relate it to yourself.
Right. You know, but either you're going to let go or you're not. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you're going to fight that fight, you know, your whole life.
I don't know. As long as it plagues me, I guess. I don't know.
Meh.
As long as I'm grappling with it, I gotta kind of give in to see where I wind up at the end of it, you know?
Uh-huh.
I don't know. I think what bothered me for a long time was just coming from these predetermined beliefs that I had,
uh-huh.
and then questioning them all, and then sort of just shutting the whole thing out for a long time.
Even the Jewish thing, you know, where, you know, you have like a history of dialogues, you know, with God and prophets and the people that are documented as having this relationship with God, is that, it really comes down to so there are lessons, but it just comes down to the difference between suspending disbelief in order to engage in this argument, all right, or just believing. Mm-hmm. I mean, some people can throw that switch. I believe, and it must be a fucking relief.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good if you can do it, you know.
Well, that's why born-again Christianity is so profound, that, you know, people who get dragged through life to a certain degree and their brain and their heart just can't take it anymore. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden it's like, you know, unburden me.
Yeah.
I pray to be... what do you call it when you to take Jesus into your heart? You know, I want to be born
Jesus-y.
Again.
Is that the word?
Jesus-y.
Jesus-y.
But the sort of like the switch you throw, like, okay, I believe. I'm crying. I'm on my knees. I'm on the mm-hmm. floor. I believe. But then after a certain point, you're like, you know, like, no, things aren't that good again. So then you go for
Buddhism and you figure, it's like, what was that movie, Hannah and Her Sisters?
Yeah.
You know, when Woody Allen tries like all the different religions.
Yeah. And then what goes out and buys the white bread.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I get all that, you know, but, you know, Woody, you know, in retrospect, you watch that documentary, you know, he believes in work.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he believes in.
Right.
And it's personal, and I think it's interesting that Spinoza, like, you know, whether he believed or he didn't is unclear. I mean, because I bet you he did.
You think so?
Yeah.
And Einstein, I believe, was a Spinozian, and then people argue the same thing about that. Well, if Einstein believed in the God of Spinoza, then does that mean that Einstein believed in God or not? And
the thing is like, you know, belief is personal in the sense that, you know, I think a lot of people are trying to explain a relationship, and it's hard to know whether they're just trying to sort of decipher a truth or to somehow figure out how to frame it. Mm-hmm. So it has meaning, you know, because, you know, deciphering a truth of God's existence or non-existence proves to be fairly difficult.
Mm-hmm.
From both sides.
Sure.
So like it would not surprise me at all that somebody like Einstein believed in God, and it was not part of his dialogue, because these are guys that speak in the human dialogue, and a lot of times, you know, it's a little bit alienating if you start your conversation with, well, you know, this morning God told me to, you know.
Sure.
Because then you're gonna be like, oh, okay, here we go.
And just saying, like, as somebody who says I believe in God, people have their own baggage that they attach to that too.
Yeah.
So they oh, he believes in God, then he believes in this and that and that, and they make their own decisions on that, just based on whatever you say you believe. So I'm often tempted not to say anything also, just because...
Well, yeah, but look, you know, in my mind, it's like, look, if you're not hurting anybody, then knock yourself out. Whatever gets you through the night.
And ultimately, you can, if you're going to hurt people, I think you're going to hurt them either in the name of God or not. I think using the name of God to hurt people is just as... It's a way, but you could also use the country. You could say, I'm hurting people in the name of the country.
Nationalism, sure. Or a political belief.
So I think that's often an argument used against believing in God, is say, hey, look, you know, once you believe in God, then what does that imply, and how are you going to use it against people? And I think ultimately human nature is that whoever you are is going to come through that filter.
See, there's the big problem. That's why it's all invented in the first place, that horrible human nature business. The flawed imperfections.
Right.
The inability to stop sinning.
But it's back to what you said. It's what do you do with it? Do you know how to use God? It's basically, here's a tool that you can either use or not, and what are you going to do with it?
I think God is like helped a lot of people not completely destroy their lives or other people's lives. I think that God is... You know, atheists and historians will say, like, you know, more blood has been shed in the name of God than anything else. And that's probably true. But I think on a personal level, you know, when someone is struggling with being human in all its horrible manifestations, you know, like, you know, driving over to shoot a man who fucked your wife, that, you know, I'd imagine that, you know, the wrestling with that action or the what you're going to get out of that action, that, you know, outside of the law being forbidding of that, that there's something, and also those are just human rules. Like, you know, I shouldn't kill a guy, but I imagine that, you know, in those moments, if you take a second and go, you know, God, I'm about to do something bad, that the vocalization of that sort of transparency, or that, you know, God sees you. Sometimes if people believe that God sees them, it might be enough to stop them from, you know, from killing a guy. They might hit him.
Yeah, but I think you're right. I think it is, even if they're not talking to anyone, it's a moment of self-reflection.
Right.
And maybe people wouldn't have that otherwise.
Moral turpitude. You know, like moral predicament.
Moral predicament. I like the word turpitude.
That's the problem with sin, you know. I mean, you know, the idea of sin was never constructed to make people feel sin is an admission that people are always going to be imperfect, and that the struggle is to, you know, to sort of be as good a person as you can be, not to be without sin. It's ongoing dialogue. It's a moral dialogue based on, you know, behavior and thoughts and the struggles of the heart. So the idea of the sins, the seven deadlies, or sin in general, is not that, you know, we got to fix this.
Mm-hmm.
It's the dialogue of humility and contrition, mm-hmm. Around moral transgression. That's what that's about.
Right. Yeah.
It's not that, like, you know, I'm going to live without sin. It's like, well, I think that's a tall order, and you're probably going to end up doing something really shitty.
Right.
if you think that.
Just do your best.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I'm doing the best I can.
Yeah.
Right. How you feeling? I'm okay. That's all right. Okay's good. Are you happy? I'm happy enough.
Yeah. Fleeting moments.
Yeah. Fleeting moments, or even ongoing moments. Sure. I just don't, this premium. Put on happiness,
right,
to the exclusion of everything else is moronic.
Yeah.
Where's the struggle? You're going to avoid the struggle unless you're a fucking idiot. You know what I mean?
Then you wind up with a different struggle, less fun one.
Yeah, and you know, and boring friends, maybe.
Or none.
Yeah, well, I think some people are happy and some people have put down the sword, and that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's good. I mean, after, yeah, you got to hit a certain age and you realize, like, oh my God, most of this is bullshit. Mm-hmm. Like that guy, that quote up there, that Jim Harrison quote, it says, "The danger of civilization, of course, is that you will piss away your life on nonsense." You know?
Yeah.
What do you make of that? Have you done Hillel?
No.
What do you make of that? What does that one mean to you? If I am not for myself, then who will be for me? And if I am only for myself, then what am I? And if not now, when?
Tomorrow.
Good, tomorrow.
Yeah, Hillel was an interesting guy. I know a bit about Hillel just from Jewish studies.
Oh, yeah?
He never got angry. That's what he's known for. Everybody used to try to piss him off, and he would never get angry. There's like a famous story about Hillel. Somebody made a bet that he could get Hillel angry, and Hillel was in the shower. And so this guy kept knocking on the door, Hillel, Rabbi Hillel. And every time he'd come out, he'd be like, what? He'd go, well, why do Asian people have different kind of eyes? I think that was one of the... He'd be like, oh. So he'd ask him all these stupid, nonsensical questions. Hillel, yeah. Hillel, you know, why are the roads made of with such a bad camber or whatever it was? So basically the guy came in and yelled at Hillel. He said, you're the worst rabbi. No rabbi should be like you. You just cost me... I don't know how much money, let's say 500 shekels, okay, for the story. And he goes, well, what happened? And he goes, you know, you lost me all this money because I'd bet that I could make you angry and I couldn't make you angry. And the famous answer Hillel gave was, it's better that you lose your money than I lose my temper. That was his famous answer.
Well, the question is, why did Hillel not get angry ever?
Because, I don't know, he was on good drugs. He was mellow
God.
All the time. Because of God, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I think because the idea was that once you lose your temper, what else could come with that? You know, you lose control, and once you lose control, you can make bad decisions. So it was very much, I think that's what Hillel was trying to say, was basically just keep yourself together as best as you can.
Okay, there we go again. Do the best you can.
Yeah.
That's it.
He was also the guy who famously was asked, tell me the whole Torah on one foot.
Yeah.
And he said, just don't do unto others as you wouldn't want done to you. That was his quote, too.
That's his? Do unto others?
Don't do unto others as you wouldn't want them to do unto you.
Okay.
That was another Hillel. Do you want to read the Spinoza quotes?
Yes. All right. Spinoza quotes.
Okay.
When you say that if I deny that the operations of seeing, hearing, attending, wishing, etc. can be ascribed to God or that they exist in him in any immanent fashion, you do not know what sort of God mine is. I suspect that you believe there is no greater perfection than such as can be explained by the aforesaid attributes. I am not astonished, for I believe that if a triangle could speak, it would say, in like manner, that God is imminently triangular, while a circle would say that the divine nature is imminently circular. Thus, each would ascribe to God its own attributes, would assume itself to be like God, and look on everything else as ill-shaped.
Yeah, that's... Again,
I get it. Yeah. I get it. It's like the... It's sort of like... you're different, so you don't... So God doesn't acknowledge you. Our God is real. Yours is a triangle.
Sure, and everybody wants God to look like them.
Yeah, selfish. I am of opinion that the revelation of God can only be established by the wisdom of the doctrine, not by miracles or in any other words by ignorance. Or in other words, by ignorance. Yeah, that the wisdom of the doctrine, that's the interpretation or your sort of relationship with what is written as opposed to the tricks.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, God, I would imagine miracles would even be relegated to, maybe they're specific, but... You know, parting the Red Sea, even you know, Adam and Eve, maybe.
Okay.
That I think that, yeah, maybe I'm wrong. I make this chief distinction between religion and superstition, that the latter is founded on ignorance, the former on knowledge.
Superstition being ignorant and religion being knowledge?
Right.
Okay. But I guess...
That makes sense, because superstition is the moron's way to explain things they don't understand.
Right, and religion is basically, here, we've broke it down like this.
And also there are teachings that you would hope are sort of designed to deal with the struggles of existential challenges, morality.
I wanted to ask you about putting down the sword, because you talked about that a little bit earlier.
Mm-hmm. Well, the sword for me was really about, you know, finding my own self and my own path. And, you know, I may not have known that, but I certainly fought a lot of fights that, I think if you're lucky, you get to a point where you're like, well, I can only do what I can do. You know, what are my limitations? You know, what is my voice? What do I have to contribute? Like, if you're just fighting for the sake of fighting, or you're fighting for something that, you know, your heart may not be into, then, you're not being true to yourself. So it's got to come from you. And in order for it to come from you, you got to know what that is. So I think for me, the fight was really just to sort of secure a place where I could, you know, become myself and speak from that place. I just find that, you know, if I'm honest about what I'm going through and what I'm thinking, that is infinitely more helpful than, you know, fighting a fight that, you know, I didn't create necessarily, or that I don't necessarily feel part of. You know, I mean, how, you know, what kind of change do you want to facilitate, or what are you trying to prove? I just decided that being open about the struggle is the best I can do. And if I come upon something that I find, you know, personally enlightening, or something that changes the way I think about something, you know, to share that process, you know, maybe people can relate to it, feel less alone, say like, oh, okay, that makes sense, and, you know, continue that dialogue. You know, as opposed to the sort of pointing over there and going, you guys are fucking idiots.
Mm-hmm.
And they are. They're fucking idiots.
And I guess at the end of that, the light at the end of that tunnel is when all the marks come together into one enlightened mark, Buddha, guru.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the circle. I'm against triangles.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Thank you.
Well, thank you again for listening. Thank you again to Mark Maron for doing the show. I want to tell you that I have a friend of mine who used to intern at Comical Radio, and his name is Rocco. He is an aspiring filmmaker, and he's working on trying to do his first movie. It's called 28 Minute Epic, and he's got a Kickstarter going for it. And I told him I would plug it, and I hope that you will support it. Go to Kickstarter.com. and type in 28-minute epic and help my buddy Rocco make his movie. I want to thank today's sponsors once again. Don't forget to go to standupcrap.com and pick up some records. Tell them I sent you. I don't know if you can. Just pick up the records. And I want to thank Tent Encounters with Jewish Culture. Remember, if you're interested in learning more about the contributions of Jews to the development of contemporary comedy, literature, art, food, journalism, comics, or music, check out www.tentsite.org. That's TENTSITE.org. It's a chance for you to meet some collaborators, workshop your own stuff, talk to leaders in the field, see great shows, and learn a lot. I did it myself last year, and it was a great time, and it's totally free. The next application deadline is February 2nd, and there are only 20 spots in each program, so don't delay. Do it today. I always hear that in commercials. Don't delay. Do it today. And go to standupcrap, standupcrap.com. Go pick up my album, Some Kind of Comedian. Go pick up Marc Maron's album, Marc Maron Final Engagement. I see it's up there on their site. Here's some more people who have been on the show. Brendan Burns. His album, Brendan Burns Pompously Lectures Americans, is available on standupcrap.com. Who else from the show? Louis Black. Louis Black Revolver. Available at standupcrap.com. That's a lot of people you've heard here. Go get the records. Buy them up. Enjoy them. And visit moderndayphilosophers.net. Donate to the show. Once again, you'll get a free tweaked audio earbud if you're one of the first 30 people to donate $20 or more. Email me at thecomical@yahoo.com. I'm always happy to hear from you. I love meeting new people that listen to the show and love hearing what you think of it. Let me know. If you like the show, do me a favor. Go on iTunes. Leave 5 stars and a nice comment. We can't get enough of those because they keep us in visibility in iTunes. So that's a big deal. Big deal for me. Great show coming to you next week. I'll be posting about it all week on Facebook.com/moderndayphilosophers. Can't wait for you to hear it. It's a really good one. In the meantime, I'll see you next Monday, everybody. Thanks again. Bye.